Now that their course of action had been determined, Hicks took a moment to check out the interior of the APC. Between the fire damage and the holes eaten by alien acid, it was clearly a write-off.
"Let's get together what we can carry. Hudson, give me a hand with the lieutenant."
The comtech eyed the paralyzed form of his commanding officer with undisguised distaste.
"How about we just sit him up in operations and strap him to the chair? He'll feel right at home."
"No, Sal. He's still alive, and we gotta get him out of here."
"Yeah, I know. Just don't keep reminding me."
"Ripley, you keep an eye on the child. She's sort of taken to you anyway."
"The feeling's mutual." She clasped Newt tightly to her.
"Vasquez, can you cover us until the dropship touches down?"
She smiled at him, showing perfect teeth.
"Can pigs fly?"
She tapped the stock of the pulse rifle. The corporal turned to face the landing team's last human member.
"You coming?"
"Don't be funny," Burke grumbled.
"I won't. Not here. This isn't a funny place."
He switched on his headset pickup.
"Bishop, you found anything out?"
The synthetic's voice filled the passenger bay.
"Not much. The equipment here is colonial-style basic. I've gone about as far as I can go with the tools available."
"It doesn't matter. We're getting out. Pack it up and meet us on the tarmac. Can you make it okay? I don't want to abandon the APC until the dropship's on final approach."
"No problem. It's been quiet back here."
"Okay. Don't take anything you can't carry easily. Move it."
The dropship rose from its place on the concrete pad, fighting the wind as it lifted. Under Pharaoh's steady hand, it hovered, pivoted in mid-air, and began to move over the colony towards the stalled APC.
"Got you on visual. Wind's let up a little. I'll set her down as close as I can," Pharaoh informed them.
"Roger."
Hicks turned to his companions.
"Ready?"
Everyone nodded except Burke, who looked sour but said nothing.
"And let's get out of here."
He cycled the door. Wind and rain poured in as the ramp extended. They filed rapidly out of the vehicle. The dropship was already in plain sight, edging towards them. Searchlights blazed from its flanks and belly. One illuminated a single human shape striding through the mist towards them.
"Bishop!"
Vasquez waved.
"Long time no see!"
he called across to her.
"Didn't work out so good, huh?"
"It stank,"
she spat downwind.
"Tell you all about it sometime."
"Later, after hypersleep, after we put this place far behind us."
She nodded, the only one of the waiting group whose attention was not monopolized by the approaching dropship. Her dark eyes continuously scanned the landscape around the personnel carrier. Nearby, Ripley waited, gripping Newt's small hand tightly. Hudson and Hicks carried the still unconscious Gorman between them.
"Hold it there," Pharaoh instructed them. "Give me a little room. I don't want to come down on top of you."
She thumped her headset pickup.
"It'd be nice if I had a little help up here, Spunkmeyer. Get off the pot."
The compartment door slid aside behind her. She glanced back over her shoulder, angry and not bothering to hide the fact.
"It's about time. Where the—"
Her eyes widened, and the rest of the accusation trailed away. It wasn't Spunkmeyer. The alien barely fitted through the opening. Outer jaws flared to reveal the inner set of teeth. There was a blur of movement and an explosive, organic whoosh. Pharaoh barely had time to scream as she was slammed backward into the control console. From below, the would-be refugees watched in dismay as the dropship veered wildly to port. Its main engines roared to life, and it accelerated even as it lost altitude. Ripley grabbed Newt and sprinted towards the nearest building.
"Run!"
The dropship clipped a rock formation at the edge of the causeway, slewed left, and struck a basalt ridge. It tumbled, turning completely on its back like a dying dragonfly, struck the tarmac, and exploded. Sections and compartments began to break away from the mainframe, some of them already afire. The body of the ship arced into the air once more, bouncing off the unyielding stone, fire blazing from its engines and superstructure. Part of an engine module slammed into the APC, setting off its armament. The personnel carrier blew itself to bits as shells and fuel exploded inside it. A flaming Catherine wheel, the remains of the dropship, skipped past and rolled into the outskirts of the atmosphere processing station. A tremendous fireball lit the dark sky of Acheron. It faded rapidly. Emerging from concealment, the stunned survivors stared at the debris in disbelief as their superior firepower and hopes of getting off the planet were simultaneously reduced to charred metal and ash.
"Well, that's great,"
said a near-hysterical Hudson.
"That's just great, man. Now what are we supposed to do? We're in some real fine shape now."
"Are you finished?"
Hicks stared hard at the comtech until Hudson looked abashed. Then he glanced at Ripley.
"You okay?"
She nodded and tried to hide her real feelings as she looked down at Newt. She could have spared herself the effort. It was impossible to hide anything from the child. Newt looked calm enough. She was breathing hard, true, but it was from the effort of racing for cover, not from fear. The girl shrugged, sounding remarkably grown up.
"I guess we're not leaving, right?"
Ripley bit her lip.
"I'm sorry, Newt." "You don't have to be sorry. It wasn't your fault."
She stared silently at the flaming wreckage of the dropship. Hudson was kicking aside rocks, bits of metal, anything smaller than his boot.
"Just tell me what we're supposed to do now. What are we going to do now?"
Burke looked annoyed.
"Maybe we could build a fire and sing songs."
Hudson took a step towards the company rep, and Hicks had to intervene.
"We should get back."
Everyone turned to look down at Newt, who was still staring at the burning dropship.
"We should get back, 'cause it'll be dark soon. They come mostly at night. Mostly."
"All right."
Hicks nodded in the direction of the ruined APC. It was mostly metal and composites and shouldn't burn much longer.
"The fire's about had it. Let's see what we can find."
"Scrap metal," suggested Burke. "And maybe something more. You coming?"
The company rep rose from where he'd been sitting.
"I'm sure not staying here."
"Up to you."
The corporal turned to their synthetic.
"Bishop, see if you can make operations livable. What I mean is, make sure it's clear."
The android responded with a gentle smile.
"Take point? I know what that means. I'm expendable, of course."
"Nobody's expendable."
Hicks started across the tarmac towards the smoking APC.
"Let's move it."
Day on Acheron was dim twilight. Night was darker than the farthest reaches of interstellar space, because not even the stars shone through its dense atmosphere to soften the barren surface with twinkling light. The wind howled around the battered metal buildings of Hadley Town, whistling down corridors and rattling broken doors. Sand pattered against cracked windows, a perpetual snare drum roll. Not a comforting sound to be heard. Inside, everyone waited for the nightmare to come. Emergency power was sufficient to light operations and its immediate environs, but not much else. There, the weary and demoralized survivors gathered to consider their options. Vasquez and Hudson had made one final run to the hulk that was the armored personnel carrier. Now they set down their prize, a large, scorched, dented packing case. Several similar cases were stacked nearby. Hicks glanced at the case and tried not to sound too disappointed. He knew what the answer to his question would be, but asked it anyhow. Maybe he was wrong.
Any ammo?
Vasquez shook her head and slumped into an office chair.
Everything was stored in the airspace between the APC's walls. It all went up when it caught fire.
She pulled off her sweat-soaked bandana and wiped a forearm across her hairline.
Man, what I wouldn't give for some soap and a hot shower.
Hicks turned towards the table on which reposed their entire weapons inventory.
This is it, then. Everything we could salvage.
His gaze examined the stock, wishing he could triple it by looking at it.
We've got 4 pulse rifles with about 50 rounds each. Not so good. About 15 M40 grenades and 2 flamethrowers, less than half full. 1 damaged. And we got 4 of these robot sentry units with their scanners and display relays intact.
He approached the stack of packing cases and broke the seal on the nearest. Ripley joined him in inspecting the contents. Stabilized in packing foam was a squat automatic weapon. Secured in a separate set of boxes next to it was matching video and movement sensor instrumentation.
Looks pretty efficient, she commented. They are.
Hicks shut the case.
Without them, I'd say we might as well cut our wrists right now. With them, well, our chances are better than none, anyway. Trouble is, we need about 100 like this one and 10 times the ammunition. But I'm grateful for small favors.
He rapped his knuckles on the hard plastic case.
If these hadn't been packed like this, they would have gone bluey with the rest of the APC.
What makes you think we stand a chance anyway?
Hudson said. Ripley ignored him.
How long after we're declared overdue can we expect a rescue?
Hicks looked thoughtful. He'd been too absorbed with the problems of their immediate survival to think about the possibility of help from outside.
We should have filed a mission update yesterday. Call it about 17 days from tonight.
The comm tech whirled and stomped off, waving his arms disconsolately.
Man, we're not going to make it 17 hours. Those things are going to come in here just like they did before, man. They're going to come in here and get us long before anyone from Earth comes poking around to see what's left of us. And they're going to find us, too, all sucked out and blown dry like those poor colonists we cremated down on sea level. Like Dietrich and Crow, man.
He started to sob. Ripley indicated the silently watching Newt.
She survived longer than that with no weapons and no training. The colonists didn't know what hit them. We know what to expect, and we got more than wrenches and hammers to fight back with. We don't have to clean them out. All we have to do is survive for a couple of weeks. Just keep them away from us and stay alive.
Hudson laughed bitterly.
Yeah, no sweat. Just stay alive. Dietrich and Crow are alive, too.
We're here, we've got some armaments, and we know what's coming. So you better just start dealing with it. Just deal with it, Hudson. Because we need you, and I'm tired of your comments.
He gaped at her, but she wasn't through.
Now get on that central terminal and call up some kind of floor plan file. Construction blueprints, maintenance schematics, anything that shows the layout of this place. I want to see air ducts, electrical access tunnels, sub-basements, water pipes, every possible way into this wing of the colony. I want to see the guts of this building, Hudson. If they can't reach us, they can't hurt us. They haven't ripped through these walls yet, so maybe that means they can't. This is colony operations. We're in the most solid structure on the planet, excepting maybe the big atmosphere processing stations. We're up off the ground, and they haven't shown any signs of being able to climb a sheer wall.
Hudson hesitated, then straightened slightly, relieved to have something to concentrate on. Hicks nodded his approval to Ripley.
Affirmative,
the comm tech told her, a little of his cockiness restored.
With it came a dram of confidence. I'm on it. You want to know where every plug is in this dump? I'll find it. He headed for the vacant computer console. Hicks turned to the synthetic. You want a job, or have you already got something in mind? Bishop looked uncertain. This was part of his social programming. An android could never be actually uncertain.
If you require me for something specific, Hicks shook his head. In that case, I'll be in medical. I'd like to continue my research. Perhaps I may stumble across something that will prove useful to us.
Fine, Ripley told him. You do that.
She was watching him closely. If Bishop was conscious of this excessive scrutiny, he gave no sign of it as he turned and headed for the lab.
Chapter 10. Once Hudson had something to work on, he moved fast. Before long, Ripley, Hicks, and Burke were clustered around the comtech, peering past him at the large flat video display. It illuminated a complex series of charts and mechanical drawings. Newt hopped from one foot to the other, trying to see around the adult's bulk. Ripley tapped the screen. This service tunnel has to be what they're using to move back and forth. Hudson studied the readout.
Yeah, right. It runs from the processing station right into the colony maintenance sublevel here.
He traced the route with a fingertip.
That's how they slipped in and surprised the colonists. That's the way I'd come, too.
All right. There's a fire door at this end. The first thing we do is put one of the remote sentries in the tunnel and seal that door.
That won't stop them.
Hicks's gaze roved over the plans.
Once they've been stopped in the service tunnel, they'll find another way in. We gotta figure on them getting into the complex eventually.
That's right. So we put up welded barricades at these intersections. She pointed to the schematic as she spoke. And seal these ducts here and here. Then they can only come at us from these two corridors, and we create a free field of fire for the other two sentry units here.
She tapped the location, her nail clicking on the hard surface of the illuminated screen.
Of course, they can always tear the roof off, but I think that'd take them a while. By then, our relief should arrive, and we'll be out of here.
We'd better be, Hicks muttered.
He studied the layout of operations intently.
Otherwise, this looks outstanding. Seal the fire door in the tunnel, weld the corridors shut, then all we need is a deck of cards to pass the time.
He straightened and eyed his companions.
All right, let's move like we got a purpose.
Hudson half-snapped to attention.
Aye, affirmative.
Next to him, Newt copied the gesture and the inflection.
Aye, affirmative.
The comtech looked down at her and smiled before he caught himself. Hopefully no one noticed the transient grin. It would ruin his reputation as an incorrigible hard case. Hudson grunted as he set the second heavy sentry gun onto its recoil-absorbing tripod. The weapon was squat, ugly, unencumbered by sights or triggers. Vasquez locked the weapon in place, then snapped on the connectors that led from the firing mechanism to the attached motion sensor. When she was certain the comtech was out of the way, she nudged a single switch marked Activate. A small green light came to life atop the gun. On the small diagnostic readout set flush in the side, Ready flashed yellow, then red. Both troopers stepped clear. Vasquez picked up a battered wastebasket that had rolled into the corridor and shouted towards the weapon's oral pickup.
Testing!
Then she threw the empty metal container out into the middle of the corridor. Both guns swiveled and let loose before the basket hit the floor, reducing the container to dime-sized shrapnel.
Hudson whooped with delight.
Take that, suckers!
He lowered his voice as he turned to Vasquez, his eyes rolling. Oh, give me a home where the firepower roams and the deer and the antelope get shot to hamburger.
You always were a sensitive type, Vasquez told him.
I know. It shows in my face.
Turning, he put a shoulder against the fire door.
Give me a hand with this.
Vasquez helped him roll the heavy steel barrier into place. Then she unpacked the high-intensity portable welding torch she'd brought with her and snapped it alight. Blue flame roared from the muzzle. She turned a dial on the handle, refining the acetylene finger.
Give me some room, man, or I'm liable to seal your foot to your boot.
Hudson complied, stepping back to watch her. He began to pace, staring down the empty service way and listening. He fingered the controls of his headset nervously.
Hudson here.
Hicks responded instantly.
How you two doing?
We're working on the big air duct you located in the plans. A and B sentries are in place and activated. Looks good. Nothing comes up this tunnel they can't pick out.
Vasquez's torch hissed nearby.
We're sealing the fire door right now.
Roger. When you're through, get yourselves back up here.
Hey, you think I want a ticket for loitering?
Hicks smiled to himself. That sounded more like the old Hudson. He nudged the tiny mic away from his lips and adjusted the thick metal plate he was carrying so that it covered the duct opening. Ripley nodded at him and shoved her plate in place. He unlimbered a duplicate of Vasquez's welder and began sealing the plate to the floor. Behind him, Burke and Newt worked busily, stacking containers of medicine and food in a corner. The aliens hadn't touched the colony's food supplies. More importantly, the water distillation system was still functioning. Since it was self-pressurized, no power was needed to draw it from the taps. They wouldn't starve or go thirsty. When he'd sealed down two-thirds of the plate, Hicks set the welder aside and extracted a small bracelet from a belt pouch. He flicked a tiny switch set flush with the metal, and a minuscule LED came to life as he handed the circlet to Ripley.
What is it? Emergency beeper. Military version of the PDTs the colonists had surgically implanted. Doesn't have the range they do, and you wear it outside instead of inside your body, but the idea is the same. With that on, I can locate you anywhere near the complex on this.
He tapped the miniature tracker that was built into his battle harness. She studied it curiously.
I don't need this.
Hey, it's just a precaution, you know. She regarded him quizzically for a moment, then shrugged and slipped the bracelet over her wrist.
Thanks. You wearing one?
He smiled and looked away.
Only got one tracker.
He tapped his harness.
I know where I am. What's next?
She forgot all about the bracelet as she consulted the hard copy printout of Hudson's schematic. Something very strange happened while they worked. They were too busy to notice, and it was left to Newt to point it out. The wind had died. Stopped utterly. In the unasheronic stillness outside the colony, a diffuse mist swirled and roiled uncertainly. In two visits to Asheron, this was the first time Ripley hadn't heard the wind. It was disquieting. The absence of wind reduced outside visibility from poor to non-existent. Fog swirled around operations, giving the world beyond the triple-paned windows the look of being underwater. Nothing moved. In the service tunnel that connected the buildings of the colony to the processing station and each other, a pair of robot guns sat silently, their motion scanners alert and humming. C gun surveyed the empty corridor, its armed light flashing green. Through a hole in the ceiling at the far end of the passageway, fog swirled in. Water condensed on bare metal walls and dripped to the floor. The gun did not fire on the falling drops. It was smarter, more selective than that, able to distinguish between harmless natural phenomena and inimical movement. The water made no attempt to advance, and so the weapon held its fire, waiting patiently for something to kill. Newt had carried boxes until she'd worn herself out. Ripley carried her from operations into the medical wing, the small head resting wearily on the woman's shoulder. Occasionally she would try to say something, and Ripley would reply as though she understood. She was hunting for a place where the child could rest quietly and in comparative safety. The operating theater was located at the far end of the medical section. Much of its complex equipment sat in recesses in the walls, while the rest hung from the ceiling at the tips of extensible arms. A large globe containing lights and additional surgical instrumentation dominated the ceiling. Cabinets and equipment not fastened down had been shoved into a corner to provide room for several folding metal cots. This was where they would sleep. This was where they would retreat to if the aliens breached the outer defenses. The inner redoubt. The keep. The operating room was sealed tighter and had thicker walls than any other part of the colony complex, or so the schematics Hudson had called forth insisted. It looked a lot like an oversized high-tech vault. If they had to shoot themselves in order to keep from falling alive into the aliens' hands, this was where any future rescuers would find the bodies. But for now, it was a safe haven, snug and quiet. Gently, Ripley lowered the girl to the nearest cot, smiling down at the upturned face.
"Now, you just lie there and have a nap. I have to go help the others, but I'll come in every chance I get to check on you. You deserve a rest. You're exhausted."
Newt stared up at her.
"I don't want to sleep." "You have to, Newt. Everybody has to sometime. You'll feel better after you had a rest."
"But I have scary dreams."
It struck a familiar chord in Ripley, but she managed to feign cheerfulness.
"Everybody has bad dreams, Newt."
The girl snuggled deeper into the padded cot.
"Not like mine."
"Don't bet on it, child," she thought.
Aloud, she said, "I'll bet Casey doesn't have bad dreams."
She disengaged the doll head from the girl's small fingers and made a show of peering inside.
"Just as I thought. Nothing bad in there. Maybe you could try to be like Casey. Pretend there's nothing in here."
She tapped the girl's forehead, and Newt smiled back.
"You mean try to make it all empty-like?" "Yes, empty-like. Like Casey."
She caressed the delicate face, brushing hair back from Newt's forehead.
"If you do that, I'll bet you'll be able to sleep without having any bad dreams."
She closed the doll head's unblinking eyes and handed it back to its owner. Newt took it, rolling her own eyes as if to say, "Don't pull that 5-year-old stuff on me, lady. I'm 6.
"Ripley, she doesn't have bad dreams, because she's just a piece of plastic." "Oh, sorry, Newt." "Well then, maybe you could pretend you're like her that way. Just made of plastic."
The girl almost smiled. Almost.
"I'll try." "Good girl. Maybe I'll try it myself."
Newt pulled Casey close up to her neck, looking thoughtful.
"My mommy always said there were no such things as monsters, no real ones. But there are."
Ripley continued to brush isolated strands of blonde hair back from the pale forehead.
"Yes, there are, aren't there? They're as real as you and me. They're not make-believe, and they didn't come out of a book. They're really real. Not fake real like the ones I used to watch on the video.
Why do they tell little kids things like that? Things that aren't true.
There was a faint tinge of betrayal in her voice. No lying to this child, Ripley knew. Not that she had the slightest intention of doing so. Newt had experienced too much reality to be fooled by a simple fib. Ripley instinctively sensed that to lie to this girl would be to lose her trust forever.
Well, some kids can't handle it like you can. The truth, I mean. They're too scared, or their grown-ups think they'll be too scared. Grown-ups have a way of always underestimating little kids' ability to handle the truth. So they try to make things easier for them by making things up.
About the monsters, did one of those things grow inside Mommy?
Ripley found some blankets and began pulling them up around the small body, tucking them tightly around narrow ribs.
I don't know, Newt. Neither does anybody else. That's the truth. I don't think anybody will ever know.
The girl considered.
Isn't that how babies come? I mean, people babies? They grow inside you?
A chill went down Ripley's spine.
No, not like that. Not like that at all. It's different with people, honey. The way it gets started is different, and the way the baby comes is different. With people, the baby and the mother work together. With these aliens, the...
I understand, Newt said, interrupting. Did you ever have a baby?
Yes.
She pushed the blanket up under the child's chin.
Just once, a little girl.
Where is she? Back on Earth?
No. She's gone.
You mean dead?
It wasn't a question. Ripley nodded slowly, trying to remember a small female thing, not unlike Newt, running and playing, a miracle with dark curls bouncing around her face. Trying to reconcile that memory with the picture of an older woman briefly glimpsed. Child and mature lady linked together through time overspent in the stasis of hypersleep. The child's father was a more distant memory still. So much of a life lost and forgotten. Youthful love marred by a lack of common sense, a brief flare of happiness smothered by reality. Divorce. Hypersleep. Time. She turned away from the bed and reached for a portable space heater. While it wasn't uncomfortable in the operating theater, it would be more comfortable with the heater on. It looked like a slab of plastic, but when she thumbed the on switch, it emitted a whir and a faint glow as its integral warming elements came to life. As the heat spread, the operating room became a little less sterile, a shade cozier. Newt blinked sleepily.
Ripley, I was thinking, maybe I could do you a favor and fill in for her. Your little girl, I mean. Nothing permanent. Just for a while. You can try it, and if you don't like it, it's okay. I'll understand. No big deal. What do you think?
It took what little remained of Ripley's determination and self-control not to break down in front of the child. She settled for hugging her tightly. She also knew that neither of them might see the light of another dawn. That she might have to turn Newt's face away during a very possible apocalyptic last moment and put the muzzle of a pulse rifle to those blonde tresses.
I think it's not the worst idea I've heard all day.
Let's talk about it later, okay?
Okay.
A shy, hopeful smile. Ripley switched off the room light and started to rise. A small hand grabbed her arm with desperate force.
Don't go! Please!
With great reluctance, Ripley disengaged her arm from Newt's grip.
It'll be all right.
I'll be in the other room, right next door. I'm not going to go anywhere else. And don't forget that that's there.
She indicated the miniature video pickup that was embedded over the doorway.
You know what that is, don't you?
A small nod in the darkness.
Uh-huh. It's a secure cam.
That's right. See? The green light's on. Mr. Hicks and Mr. Hudson checked out all the secure cams in this area to make sure all of them were operating properly.
It's watching you, and I'll be watching its monitor over in the other room. I'll be able to see you just as clearly in there as I can when I'm right here.
When Newt still seemed to hesitate, Ripley unsnapped the tracer bracelet Hicks had given her. She slipped it around the girl's smaller wrist, clenching it tight.
Here, this is for luck. It'll help me keep an eye on you, too. Now go to sleep, and don't dream, okay? I'll try.
The sound of a small body sliding down between clean sheets. Ripley watched in the dim light from the instruments on standby as the girl turned onto her side, hugging the doll head and gazing through half-lidded eyes at the steadily glowing function light embedded in the bracelet. The space heater hummed comfortingly as she backed out of the room. Other half-opened eyes were twitching erratically back and forth. They were the only visible evidence that Lieutenant Gorman was still alive. It was an improvement of sorts, one step further from complete paralysis. Ripley leaned over the table on which the lieutenant was lying, studying the eye movements and wondering if he could recognize her.
How is he? I see he's got his eyes open.
That might be enough to wear him out. Bishop looked up from a nearby workbench. He was surrounded by instruments and shining medical equipment. The light of the single high-intensity lamp he was working with threw his features into sharp relief, giving his face a macabre cast.
Is he in pain?
Not according to his bio-readouts. They're hardly conclusive, of course. I'm sure he'll let us know as soon as he regains the use of his larynx. By the way, I've isolated the poison. Interesting stuff. It's a muscle-specific neurotoxin. Affects only the non-vital parts of the system. Leaves respiratory and circulatory functions unimpaired. I wonder if the creatures instinctively adjust the dosage for different kinds of potential hosts.
I'll ask one of them first chance I get.
As she stared, one eyelid rose all the way before fluttering back down again.
Either that was an involuntary twitch, or else he winked at me. Is he getting better?
Bishop nodded. The toxin seems to be metabolizing. It's powerful, but the body appears capable of breaking it down. It's starting to show up in his urine. Amazing mechanism, the human body. Adaptable. If he continues to flush the poison at a constant rate, he should wake up soon.
Let me get this straight. The aliens paralyzed the colonists they didn't kill, carried them over to the processing station, and cocooned them to serve as hosts for more of those?
She pointed into the back room where the stasis cylinders held the remaining facehugger specimens.
Which would mean lots of those parasites, right? One for each colonist? Over 100 at least, assuming a mortality rate during the final fight of about a third.
Yes, that follows. Bishop readily agreed.
But these things, the parasitic facehugger form, come from eggs. So where are all the eggs coming from? When the guy who first found the alien ship reported back to us, he said there were a lot of eggs inside, but he never said how many. And nobody else ever went in after him to look. And not all those eggs may have been viable. The thing is, judging from the way the colony here was overwhelmed, I don't think the first aliens had time to haul eggs from that ship back here. That means they had to come from somewhere else.
That is the question of the hour. Bishop swiveled his chair to face her. I have been pondering it ceaselessly since the true nature of the disaster here first became apparent to us.
Any ideas, bright or otherwise?
Without additional solid evidence, it is nothing more than a supposition.
Go ahead and suppose, then.
We could assume a parallel to certain insect forms who have a hive-like organization. An ant or termite colony, for example, is ruled by a single female, a queen, who is the source of new eggs. Ripley frowned. Interstellar navigation to entomology was a mental jump she wasn't prepared to make.
Don't insect queens come from eggs also?
The synthetic nodded. Absolutely.
What if there was no queen egg aboard the ship that brought these things here?
There's no such thing in a social insect society as a queen egg until the workers decide to create one. Ants, bees, termites, all employ essentially the same method. They select an ordinary egg and feed the pupa developing inside a special food high in certain nutrients. Among bees, for example, it is called royal jelly. The chemicals in the jelly act to change the composition of the maturing pupa so that what eventually emerges is an adult queen and not another worker. Theoretically, any egg can be used to hatch a queen. Why the insects choose the particular eggs they do is something we still do not know.
You're saying that one of those things lays all the eggs?
Well, not exactly like one we're familiar with. Only if the insect analogy holds up. Assuming it does, there could be other similarities. An alien queen analogous to an ant or termite queen could be much larger physically than the aliens we have so far encountered. A termite queen's abdomen is so bloated with eggs that she can't move by herself at all. She is fed and tended by workers, mated to drones, and defended by highly specialized warriors. She is also quite harmless. On the other hand, a queen bee is far more dangerous than any worker bee because she can sting many times. She is the center of their lives, quite literally the mother of their society. In one respect, at least, we are fortunate that the analogy does not hold up. Ants and bees develop from eggs directly to larvae, pupae, and adults. Each alien embryo requires a live host in which to mature. Otherwise, Acheron would be covered with them by now.
Funny, but that doesn't reassure me a whole lot. These things are a lot bigger than any ant or termite. Could they be intelligent? Could this hypothetical queen? That's something we never could decide on back on the Nostromo. We were too busy trying to keep from getting killed. Not much time for speculation.
It's hard to say. Bishop looked thoughtful. There is one thing worth considering, though.
What's that?
It may have been nothing more than blind instinct. Attraction to the heat, or whatever, but she did choose, assuming she exists, to incubate her eggs in the one spot in the colony where we couldn't destroy her without destroying ourselves. Beneath the heat exchangers at the processing plant. If that site was chosen from instinct, it means that they may be no brighter than your average termite. If, on the other hand, it was selected on the basis of intelligence, well, then I think we're in very deep trouble indeed. That's if there's any reality to these suppositions at all. Despite the distance involved, the eggs these aliens hatched from might have been brought down here by the first ones to emerge. There might be no queen involved at all. No complex alien society. Whether by intelligence or instinct, though, we have seen that they cooperate. That's something we don't have to speculate on. We've seen them in action. Ripley stood there and considered the ramifications of Bishop's analysis. None of them were encouraging, nor had she expected any to be. She nodded towards the stasis cylinders. I want those specimens destroyed as soon as you're done with them. You understand? The android glanced towards the two live facehuggers pulsing malevolently in their tubular prisons. He looked unhappy. Mr. Burke gave instructions that they were to be kept alive in stasis for return to the company laboratories. He was very specific. The wonder of it was that she went for the intercom instead of the nearest weapon. Burke! A faint whisper of static failed to mar his reply. Yes, that's you, isn't it, Ripley?
You bet it's me. Where are you?
Scavenging while there's still time. I thought I might learn something on my own, since I just seem to be in everybody's way up there.
Meet me in the lab.
Now? But I'm still...
Now!
She closed the connection and glared at the inoffensive Bishop.
You come with me.
Obediently, he put his work aside and rose to follow her. That was all she was after, to make sure that he'd obey an order if she gave it. It meant he wasn't completely under Burke's sway, company machine or no company machine.
Never mind, forget it.
I shall be happy to accompany you if that's what you wish.
That's all right. I've decided to handle it on my own. You continue with your research. That's more important than anything else.
He nodded, looking puzzled, and resumed his seat. Burke was waiting for her outside the entrance to the lab. His expression was bland.
This better be important. I think I was on to something, and we may not have much time left.
You may not have any time left. He started to protest, and she cut him off with a gesture.
No, in there.
She gestured at the operating theater. It was soundproofed inside, and she could scream at him to her heart's content without drawing everyone else's attention. Burke ought to be grateful for her thoughtfulness. If Vasquez overheard what the company representative had been planning, she wouldn't waste time arguing with him. She'd put a bullet through him on the spot.
Bishop tells me you have intentions of taking the live parasites home in your pocket. That true?
He didn't try to deny it.
They're harmless in stasis. Those suckers aren't harmless unless they're dead. Don't you understand that yet? I want them killed as soon as Bishop's gotten everything out of them he can.
Be reasonable, Ripley. A ghost of the old self-assured corporate smile stole over Burke's face.
Those specimens are worth millions to the bioweapons division of the company. Okay, so we nuke the colony. I'm outvoted on that one, but not on this. Two lousy specimens, Ripley. How much trouble could they cause while secured in stasis? And if you're worried about something happening when we get them back to the Earthside labs, don't. We have people who know how to handle things like these. Nobody knows how to handle things like these. Nobody's ever encountered anything like them. You think it'd be dangerous for some germs to get loose from a weapons lab? Try to imagine what would happen if just one of those parasites got loose in a major city, with its thousands of kilometers of sewers and pipes and glass fiber channels to hide in. They're not going to get loose. Nothing can break a stasis field. No sail, Burke. There's too much we don't know about these monsters. It's too risky. Come on, I know you're smarter than this.
He was trying to mollify and persuade her at the same time.
If we play it right, we can both come out of this heroes, set up for life.
Is that the way you really see it? She eyed him askance.
Carter Burke, alien smasher? Didn't what happened in sea level of the processing station make any impression on you at all?
They went in underprepared and overconfident. Burke's tone was flat, unemotional. They got caught in tight quarters where they couldn't use the proper tactics and weapons.
If they'd all used their pulse rifles and kept their heads and managed to get out without shooting up the heat exchangers, they'd all be here now, and we'd be on our way back to the Sulaco instead of holed up in operations like a bunch of frightened rabbits. Sending them in like that was Gorman's decision, not mine. And besides, those were adult aliens they were fighting, not parasites.
I didn't hear you object loudly when strategy was being discussed.
Who would have listened to me? Don't you remember what Hicks said? What you said? Gorman wouldn't have been any different.
His tone turned sarcastic.
This is a military expedition.
Forget the whole idea, Burke. You couldn't pull it off even if I let you.
Just try getting a dangerous organism past ICC quarantine. Section 22350 of the Commerce Code.
You've been doing your homework. That's what the code says, all right. But you're forgetting one thing. The code's nothing but words on paper.
Paper never stopped a determined man.
If I have 5 minutes alone with a customs inspector on duty when we turn through Gateway Station, we'll get them through.
Leave that end of it to me. The ICC can't impound something they don't know anything about.
But they will know about it, Burke.
How? First they'll want to talk to us, then they'll make us walk through a detection tunnel. Big deal. By the time the relief team gets around to inspecting our luggage, I'll have made the necessary arrangements with the ship's personnel to set up the stasis tube somewhere down near the engine or waste products recycling. We'll pick them up and slip off the relief ship the same way. Everyone will be so busy shooting questions at us, they'll have no time for checking cargo. Besides, everyone will know we found a devastated colony and that we got out as fast as we could. No one will be looking for us to smuggle anything back in. The company will back me up on this, Ripley, especially when they see what we brought them.
They'll take good care of you, too, if that's what you're worrying about.
I'm sure they'll back you up, she said. I don't doubt that for an instant.
Any outfit that would send less than a dozen soldiers out here with an inexperienced goofball like Gorman in charge after hearing my story is capable of anything.
You worry too much.
Sorry, I like living. I don't like the idea of waking up some morning with an alien monstrosity exploding out of my chest.
That's not going to happen. You bet it isn't.
Because if you try taking those ugly little pterotoids out of here, I'll tell everyone on the rescue ship what you're up to.
This time, I think people will listen to me.
Not that it would ever get that far. All I have to do is tell Vasquez or Hicks or Hudson what you have in mind. They won't wait around for a directive, and they'll use more than angry words.
So you might as well give it up, Burke.
She nodded in the direction of the cylinders.
You're not getting them out of this lab, much less off the surface of this planet.
Suppose I can convince the others?
You can't. But supposing for a minute that you could, how would you go about convincing them that you're not responsible for the deaths of the 157 colonists here?
Burke's combativeness drained away, and he turned pale.
Now, wait a second. What are you talking about?
You heard me. The colonists. All those poor, unsuspecting, good company people. Like Newt's family. You said I'd been doing my homework, remember?
You sent them to that ship to check out the alien derelict.
I just checked it out in the colony log. It's as intact as the plans Hudson called up. Would make interesting reading in court. Company Directive 612-9, dated 5-13-79. Proceed to inspect possible electromagnetic emission at coordinates. But I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, am I? Signed, Burke, Carter J.
She was trembling with anger.
It was all spilling out of her at once, the frustration and fury at the incompetence and greed that had brought her back to this world of horror.
You sent them out there, and you didn't even warn them, Burke. You sat through the inquest. You heard my story. Even if you didn't believe everything, you must have believed enough of it to want the coordinates checked out. You must have thought there was something to it, or you wouldn't have gone to the trouble of having everyone go out there to look around. Out to the alien ship. You might not have believed, but you suspected. You wondered. Fine. Have it checked out, but checked out carefully by a fully equipped team, not some independent prospector, and warn them of what you suspected. Why didn't you warn them, Burke?
Warn them about what? He protested. He'd heard only her words, hadn't sensed the moral outrage in her voice. That in itself explained a great deal. She was coming to understand Carter J. Burke quite well.
Look, maybe the thing didn't even exist, right? Maybe there wasn't much to it. All we had to go on was your story, which was a bit much to take at face value.
Was it?
The Narcissus's recorder was tampered with, Burke. Remember me telling the Board of Inquiry about that? You wouldn't happen to know what happened to the recorder, would you?
He ignored the question.
What do you think would have happened if I'd stuck my neck out and made it into a major security situation?
I don't know, she said tightly. Enlighten me.
Colonial administration would have stepped in. That means government officials looking over your shoulder at every turn, paperwork coming out of your ears, no freedom of movement at all. Inspectors crawling all over the place, looking for an excuse to shut you down and take over in the name of the almighty public interest. No exclusive development rights, nothing. The fact that your story turned out to be right is as much a surprise to me as everyone else.
He shrugged, his manner as blasé as ever.
It was a bad call, that's all.
Something finally snapped inside Ripley. Surprising both of them, she grabbed him by the collar and slammed him against the wall.
Bad call? These people are dead, Burke. 157 of them, less one kid, all dead because of your bad call. That's not counting Apone and the others torn apart or paralyzed over there.
She jerked her head in the direction of the processing station.
Well, they're gonna nail your hide to the shed, and I'll be standing there helping to pass out the nails when they do. That's assuming your bad call lets any of us get off this chunk of gravel alive. Think about that for a while.
She stepped away from him, shaking with anger. At least the alien's motivations were comprehensible. Burke straightened his back and his shirt, pity in his voice.
You just can't see the big picture, can you? Your worldview is restricted exclusively to the here and now. You've no interest in what your life could be like tomorrow. Not if it includes you, I don't. I expected more of you, Ripley. I thought you would be smarter than this. I thought I'd be able to count on you when the time came to make the critical decisions. Another bad call on your part, Burke. Sorry to disappoint you.
She spun on her heel and abandoned the observation room, the door closing behind her. Burke followed her with his eyes, his mind a whirl of options. Breathing hard, she strode towards operations as the alarm began to sound. It helped to take her mind off the confrontation with Burke. She broke into a run. Chapter 11. Hudson had the portable tactical console set up next to the colony's main computer terminal. Wires trailed from the console to the computer, a rat's nest of connections that enabled whoever sat behind the tactical board to interface with the colony's remaining functional instrumentation. Hicks looked up as Ripley entered operations and slapped a switch to kill the alarm. Vasquez and Hudson joined her in clustering around the console.
They're coming, he informed them quietly.
Just thought you'd like to know. They're in the tunnel already.
Ripley licked her lips as she stared at the console readouts. Are we ready for them? The corporal shrugged, adjusted a gain control.
Ready as we can be. Assuming everything we've set up works. Manufacturer's warranties aren't going to be a lot of use to us if something shorts out when it's supposed to be firing, like those sentry guns. They're about all we've got.
Don't worry, man. It'll work. Hudson looked better than at any time since the initial assault on the processing station's lower levels. I've set up hundreds of those suckers. Once the ready lights come on, you can leave them and forget them. I just don't know if they'll be enough.
No use worrying about it. We're throwing everything we got left at them. Either the RSS guns will stop them or they won't. Depends on how many of them there are.
Hicks thumbed a couple of contact switches. Everything read out online and operational. He glanced at the readouts for the motion sensors mounted on A and B guns. They were blinking rapidly, the strobe speeding up until both lights shone steadily. At the same time, a crash of heavy gunfire made the floor quiver slightly.
Guns A and B, tracking and firing on multiple targets.
He looked up at Hudson.
You give good firepower.
The comtech ignored Hicks, watching the multiple readouts.
Another dozen guns, he muttered under his breath. That's all it would take if we had another dozen guns.
A steady rumble echoed through the complex as the automatic weapons pounded away beneath them. Twin ammo counters on the console shrank inexorably towards single digits.
50 rounds per gun. How are we going to stop them with only 50 rounds per gun?
Hicks murmured.
They must be wall to wall down there.
Hudson gestured at the readouts.
Look at those ammo counters go. It's a shooting gallery down there.
What about the acid? Ripley wondered. I know those guns are armored, but you've seen that stuff at work. It'll eat through anything.
As long as the guns keep firing, that'll be okay,
Hicks told her.
Those RSS shells have a lot of impact. If it keeps blowing them backward, that'll keep the acid away. It'll spray all over the walls and floor, but the guns should stay clear.
That certainly seemed to be what was happening in the service tunnel, because the robot sentries kept up their steady barrage. 2 minutes went by. 3. The counter on B gun reached 0, and the thunder below was reduced by half. Its motion sensor continued to flicker on the tactical readout as the empty weapon tracked targets it could no longer fire upon.
B gun's dry. 20 left on A.
Hicks watched the counter, his throat dry.
10, 5. That's it.
A grim silence descended over operations. It was shattered by a reverberating boom from below. It was repeated at regular intervals like the thunder of a massive gong. Each of them knew what the sound meant.
They're at the fire door, Ripley muttered.
The booming increased in strength and ferocity. Audible, along with a deeper rumble, was another new sound. The nerve-wracking scrape of claws on steel.
Think they can break through there?
Ripley thought Hicks looked remarkably calm. Assurance or resignation?
One of them ripped a hatch right off the APC when it tried to pull Gorman out, remember?
She reminded him. Vasquez nodded towards the floor.
That ain't no hatch down there. That's a Class A double A fire door. 3 layers of steel alloy with carbon fiber composite laid between. The door'll hold. It's the welds I'm worried about. We didn't have much time. I'd feel better if I'd had a couple of bars of chromite solder and a laser instead of a gas torch to work with.
And another hour, Hudson added. Why don't you wish for a couple of Katusha 6 anti-personnel rockets while you're at it? One of those babies would clean out the whole tunnel.
The intercom buzzed for attention, startling them. Hicks clicked it on.
Bishop here. I heard the guns. How we doing?
As well as can be expected. A and B sentries are out of ammo, but they must have done some damage.
That's good, because I'm afraid I have some bad news.
Hudson made a face and leaned back against a cabinet.
Well, now that's a switch.
What kind of bad news? Hicks inquired. It will be easier to explain and show you at the same time. I'll be right over.
We'll be here.
Hicks flipped the intercom off.
Charming.
Hey, no sweat, said the jaunty comtech. We're already in the toilet, so why worry?
The android arrived quickly and moved to the single high window that overlooked much of the colony complex. The wind had picked back up and blown off the clinging fog.